Fruto, I'm going to let a few of these tennisers go by. I won't use my whole 10 minutes in asking you questions. Just have one or two. On asyndeton, I agree, by the way, that it's quite common in Greek for you to be able to use two or three words to describe the same thing, whether it's hendiadys or tridiadys and so forth kind of a thing. Just want to know if you think that the fact that the three words appear in asyndeton necessitates that they be a reference to the canonical psalms, or is it also possible they're a reference to three different categories of music that are simply placed together to refer qualitatively? So do you see that as sort of an open and shut case, or a place where the greater weight of the opinion leans one way than it does the other?
I would say the greater weight of the opinion weighs in the direction of the canonical psalms. And it's not just that we have a syndeton here, but it's how the language, I would say, is used in the Septuagint and in other references in the Old Testament, where the idea of song, for example, when David instituted a song in the tabernacle in 1 Chronicles 16, the idea of song there is, it seems, in context, a reference to the Psalms, because you have an inclusio in 1 Chronicles 16, where the writer speaks about the institution, David's institution, at the beginning of the chapter and at the end of the chapter, and then the example of selected psalm portions that are given in the middle of the chapter. So the idea of songs there appears clearly to be a reference to the Psalter, since the Psalter is quoted there. And you have the same idea in other texts, it seems. So I would say the weight goes to it's not just the fact that it's the figure of speech there.
And then a point that we all agree with, you cited Voss especially, and to a lesser degree Calvin. I think you and I, and probably everyone in this room, agrees that every good, even hymn writer that we've ever known, even for those who don't use them in worship, I think we all agree that all great hymn writers have read the Psalms avidly and have drunk deeply of the Psalms, and their hymns attempt in a more overtly Christian way to manifest the same realities of the Psalter. So I resonate with what Voss said. However, if Calvin concurred that, did not Voss use language, hard to find a more perfect guide to our subjective reaction to God's work, something like that. I just want to toss it out and see if you want to, and you don't have to if you don't want to. So just toss the tennis ball out there. If Calvin concurred that they were a perfect guide, why would he have employed the Nunc Dimittis, the Creed, and the Decalogue in the Strasbourg liturgy?
Great question. I'm not sure I can answer that. He didn't. It's obvious that those New Testament songs, if you want to characterize them this way, were included in Calvin's liturgy, and he wanted to use them, and particularly the Decalogue, I think, for the purpose of memorizing the Decalogue, that was probably Calvin's idea there, because he held the law in great esteem, as we know, and wanted the people to understand the law. Outside of that, I think it's a great question.
So, and possibly, you know, when people say, could we find a more perfect guide? Sometimes you use that language, perfect, maybe not with a capital P, but with a small p. Hard to imagine, humanly speaking, a better guide, but possibly a little here and there, and maybe Calvin had a small p kind of understanding of the same thing, and Voss more a capital P.
Yeah,
that's possible. And by the way, I don't know if the RPA does this, because I don't know if you're permitted to, but in the current edition of the Red Trinity hymnal, you know, the musical setting of the Decalogue there is the Geneva musical setting. That's why it's so difficult for people to sing. because it's an old Renaissance melody. Very, very odd kind of a thing. And when we say, why did they choose that difficult melody? The answer is, it's the Geneva melody that Calvin used. And so they just put it into English meter and did it there. So there are others also finding it memorable when you put it to music. I only had a third one, and that is this. Let's concede that it's possible that the song hymns and spiritual is a reference to the Old Testament canonical Psalms. I'll try to demonstrate later that why I'm not persuaded. But do you care to answer my mention to the three times that Luke says the book of the Psalms? Would that not have been an easier, less corrigible, less debatable way for Paul to have referred to the Psalms had he wanted to? Or am I the only one that feels a little weight there?
It would seem to me that in the Gospels, Luke's reference is referring to the Psalms. It's not necessary for him to narrow the idea as closely as it appears, at least I would argue the case, as Paul's interest implies in Colossians 3:16, that in the Gospels the Old Testament quotations are given to us in several different ways, and the term fulfilled is used in several different ways. And so it's a little hard for us sometimes to distinguish how the texts are used. But at any rate, I think Luke's interest there is simply to refer to the Psalter. This is what is given to us in the Old Testament. Whereas in the case of Colossians 3:16, it appears to me at least that Paul's interest is to narrow the scope of our singing. And he does so purposefully, you see. Mm-hmm. And so that's his idea. I would submit then that the reason he does this is the power of music, which we would properly understand and agree about, and the necessity, therefore, to narrow the scope of our singing and give certain parameters to the church so that the church is not off doing, and quote, its own thing, but really concentrating on letting this word of Christ dwell richly within them so that the image of Christ really begins to be built in them. And again, it seems to me that this is where Voss is going with his idea of subjective response.
And then the final one, because it flows right out of that, in terms of this God's objective work and our subjective response, the citations you made from Voss and others, do you grant any weight that it might have been useful if we'd had some such biblical text dealing with some aspect of the person and work of Christ overtly? A biblical guide that actually speaks as overtly about the work of Christ as the Psalms speak overtly about Babylonian captivity and only implicitly about Christ.
See, I would argue that the Psalms do not speak only implicitly about Christ, but that the Psalms do speak directly about Christ, and the witness would be that our Lord himself and the apostles preach Christ from the Old Testament and preach Christ from the Psalms. Jesus on the Emmaus Road, he spoke to the disciples all the things concerning himself from the Psalms and the prophets and Moses. And so I would say that, no, it's not just implicit reference, but explicit reference.
Mr. Moderator, I'm done with my questions. Have no tennis balls to swing at.
We're going to proceed then to Dr. Fruteau's examination of Dr. Gordon. Dr. Gordon, you may take the stand.
You may take the witness stand.
Your Honor, I never saw the woman before in my life.
Oh, please. I'm interested in your talking a little bit more about the fact that you hold that the Israelites, as you wrote in a recent article, were not exclusive psalm singers.
Yeah, some of you are familiar that I wrote a little thing, Israelites were not exclusive psalm singers, nor are we, and Dr. Pruto is referring to that particular essay. In that essay, I suggested that if you look at the historical books of the Old Testament, you'll find a number of times where there's the recording of some song of praise. We think especially of the song of Deborah, the song of Moses, and so forth, the song of the sea, that are never found in the canonical Psalter, and yet the Israelites did sing them. And the narrator seems to suggest, when he narrates that they did so, that he approves of the fact that they sang them. So it appears that there were many things they sang that, as it were, made it into the Psalter, other things they sang that were not placed in the Psalter. And so what I suggest is that the Psalter was always a growing revision, the way we revise our hymnals, or the way, for instance, the RPNA, 6 years ago or seven, completed the revision of the RPNA Psalter from the old Brown version to the new one, that the process was never final. The process was always ongoing. So that's all I suggest, is that it doesn't appear to me that they would have stopped composing new hymns until Yahweh stopped new acts of creation or deliverance.
So your argument, if I understand what you're saying, your argument, at least in part, rests on the fact that the Israelites, in response to great acts of God, the Exodus and Exodus 15,
And the conquest of the land, the song of Deborah,
etc. Those kinds of songs militate against the fact that the Israelites were. I'm correct in my thinking there.
Yeah, that's right. My reason is that they wouldn't have closed their hymnal until they closed their canon.
They wouldn't have closed their. Enlighten us on that idea
just a little bit. That is to say, the. One of the wonderful things about Voss's observation is the Psalter provides for us the right subjective response to God's objective acts.
Right? Right.
That's what's going on existentially with them. That's what's going on. And so as long as God is doing unusual acts, not his more ordinary acts of providence, but his special acts of delivering his people from their enemies and so forth, I would have expected, as long as there's an ongoing record of his doing such things, we would expect that they would respond to that ongoing record with devotional expressions of thanksgiving and praise for those activities. And so that if God stopped acting, they would have no reason to compose new ones, perhaps. But if he were to continue such acts, that they would have continued to sing about them.
Okay. Then I take it that you would draw no distinction between occasional times of God's people gathering, and I would use the term occasional with reference to the gathering of God's people after they crossed the Red Sea and Miriam led them in worship. It was on that occasion that they worshiped God. You mentioned Deborah. This kind of occasional worship and the stated, the regular stated worship of God's people in the temple, that you're not making any distinction between those two.
I'm open to the distinction because at least our standards make that distinction in chapter 21 on the regular versus the occasional elements mm-hmm. of worship. So baptism, we can't do every week if we don't have a candidate for baptism. So we call that an occasional element of worship, and the other things we call regular elements of worship. So I have no problem theologically with that distinction. But what I see in Israel is that throughout her life, as important moments come along, and this is all the way over to later in the Habakkuk, we have one, for instance, all the way through, they seem to compose devotional compositions that grow out of their subjective response to God's objective act. And so what we then see in the canon is the collecting of what they regard to be as a representative group of those.
I'm drawing the distinction between certain occasions where God's people gathered and sang praise to God. And the formal stated worship that was designed by God in the temple.
Versus more special occasions like the inauguration of a governor or something like that.
Correct. Or like a 4th of July celebration. And it was in the temple, in the stated worship of God, where David initiated the use of the Psalms. And then later in 2 Chronicles, so I just get your reaction to this, later in 2 Chronicles, when Hezekiah revived the true worship of God in accordance with David. This is 2 Chronicles 29:30. It says, "And Hezekiah the king and the officials commanded the Levites to sing praises to the Lord with the words of David and Asaph the seer."
Oh, that's very helpful.
And it seems, just before you respond, it seems that what Hezekiah is doing is narrowing, again, the song which is permissible in the temple services. And this is why drawing the distinction between the temple services, which highly regulated, and occasional settings.
Yeah, let me have the reference to the...
2 Chronicles 29:30. And earlier text speaks about Hezekiah reviving the worship in accordance with the prophet Nathan, and et cetera.
Yeah, that helps. That's much clearer than I might have thought the question was. Here's the analogy. There's two possibilities here. One possibility, as you suggest, is that they are at this point issuing sort of an ongoing directive that, let's say, from this moment on, the Levites are to sing praises to the Lord with the words of David and Asaph the seer, and perhaps no others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's entirely possible. I think
in the temple service.
Right. I also think there's two other possibilities. And that is that when the Levites, who are but a type of the coming work of Christ, when their work gives way to the mediation of Christ and the people of God, not just one twelfth of the people of God, but all the people of God come there, that just as our general life is not as highly regulated as the life of the Levites was, because they were much more regulated than the other 11 tribes, it's quite possible that our worship is less precisely regulated than theirs was. We don't have the stuff on our hems of our garments and so forth. But more important, I think, is this. A command to do a thing does not necessarily imply negatively that they not do anything else. Last Sunday night, I was filling the pulpit. At my size, I was trying to fill the pulpit at a church in Grove City. And when I finished with the sermon and the prayer, I instructed the congregation to stand and sing hymn number 230, "Thou who was rich beyond all splendor, all for love's sake becamest poor." Now, in instructing them to sing that hymn on that occasion, I don't know that I was instructing them not to sing anything else. So the other question I have is, here we have a candid record that they commanded the Levites to do this, right? But I'm not sure logically it means that their intention was that they never do anything else. Just not sure that that's implicit in it, any more than that my selecting one hymn to be sung on that occasion necessarily meant that that was the only one out of 700 hymns in there that they could sing. They might could have sung others by other people.
We have 2 minutes? Huh. We were behind. I would say, just in responding to that, to me that's counterintuitive as far as the reading of the text is concerned.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm done.
Dr. Pluto wants another break.